A hologram of Xi Jinping, the old Communist Party leader, appeared behind him, accompanied by a recording of a speech he'd given to the old party Congress in 2013. "However deep the water may be, we will wade into the water. This is because we have no alternative." The image of the long-dead president elicited a nervous murmur in the room. "Many of you are familiar with the speech, what she called the Chinese dream. The old party leaders were wrong in many things, but in this they were right. America's rise came first with its ensuring control of its home waters, and then extending its global economic presence. And then, the country had no choice but to assume its new responsibilities, including protecting the system from the powers of the past that would threaten it." I mentioned their thinker Mahan. Soon after he laid out the new demands upon the United States, war with Spain followed, as you remember, and the Americans reached across the Pacific, thousands of miles beyond their home waters, extending to the Philippines, patrolling not just our ports but even our very rivers. Just as Mahan told them, we similarly have no choice but to meet these demands. Wong took in the room, searching for signs of understanding but also dissent. A civilian on the far side of the room took the pause as an invitation. Chen Shi was the chairman of Belcon, China's top producer of consumer electronics, which had been formed by the merging of dozens of firms during the most recent crisis. His role on the directorate's presidium, though, was an extension of his reputation as a strategist and visionary in business, something that perfectly fit the directorate's hybrid of military authority and market-inspired efficiency. "Admiral, you began with a quote from The Art of War, so I will match you. Those who know when to fight and when not to fight are victorious." He paused. "I do not see your logic here. We always have choices. Does your old vision of power actually matter anymore in a world where we can choose to buy anything anywhere? These notions you describe risk all that we have accomplished." Admiral Wong nodded. "Then this failing is mine and mine alone, if I have not made the case properly." He turned to the map, pausing to collect his thoughts. Along the wall, the naval commandos stood unnervingly still and held their weapons at the ready. Wong smiled at them and continued. "All of us here who first formed the directorate acted to pull order back from chaos. We choose to act, but we acted because there was no other choice in the end," he said. "In turn, who can argue that this is not the purpose of the directorate? Thousands of years have brought us to this point. We protected China from the party leaders who held the country back, and we should not grow meek on the brink of the next great step." A young woman's voice cut through the room.
"Desire and ability are not the same thing, Admiral," said Mu Yi Ling.
Mu Yi was not yet 30, but thanks to her father's wealth, she now ran Weibot, the largest manufacturing consortium.
"Didn't General Sun also say, avoid overconfidence, as it will lead to disaster?"
Damn those viz glasses. While the old man might have known Sun Tzu by heart, Wong doubted she did. He noticed the director at commando closest to him shift his weight slightly. Maybe they were not naval commandos at all, despite the uniforms. Could they be from the 788th Regiment which protected the Presidium? Were they letting him hang himself word by word for threatening the status quo that so many in the Presidium had profited from?
"That is always a concern. But as Sun also said, make no assumptions about all the dangers of using military force. Then you won't make assumptions about the benefits of using arms either."
She smiled, but he saw her eyes scanning her glasses rather than looking directly at him. She was likely researching a retort. He realized that he had to move the discussion beyond the level of trading quotations. Wong turned to the wider group.
"Of course, we are all aware of the reasons given for why it will never be our time. Our population demographics are not optimal, they say. Our trade routes are too vulnerable, they say. Our need for outside energy is too great, they say. These statements are all true. And they will always be true if we turn our backs on our duty to make our destiny manifest. The worst thing we can do is fear our own potential."
His smart ring finger clicked one last time, and around them played the famous scene of the tank in People's Square, crushing the old Communist Party's riot control truck. The crowd of protesters' initial looks of surprise, and then their celebration as they realized that the military was on their side. He saw a few instinctively nodding their approval, reliving the moment when they had remade China into their vision.
I have abused your time, so I will end my presentation with three questions. First, just as we acted then to meet the people's true expectations of their nation's leaders, we must ask, what would the people expect of us now? Second, what do you expect the Americans to do once they learn of our energy discovery? Third and most important is a simple question of the arc of history. If now is not the time, then when? You know the answers to these questions, and thus you know that you, the truly powerful, actually have no choice. Admiral Lin appeared at Wang's shoulder and placed a hand on his back. Wang noticed that the commandos now surrounded them. Perhaps he had gone too far.
Admiral, the Presidium thanks you for your views, said Lin. These men will see you out. As Wang walked down the hallway, wedged between the commandos, he replayed the presentation in his mind. He could find faults with his performance, but he was at peace. At the elevator door, the commandos stood in silence. Wang wondered where they would take him next. Then he noticed that they were tensing up as the elevator lights numbered even closer to their floor. The door opened and another armed phalanx emerged. These bodyguards were Caucasian in ethnicity and wearing civilian suits, but they were clearly military. While the two groups eyed each other warily, Wang watched how the elderly man in the middle didn't bother even to look up from the outdated computer tablet he tapped away on. Red diamonds and purple hearts reflected in his traditional eyeglasses. He was surprisingly fit for his age, but supposedly the old Russian spy was addicted to memory-improving games, an effort to stave off what Directorate Intelligence suspected was dementia. A strong body still, but not the mind. So, Wang realized, this had not been a strategy session, but an audition. The Presidium had already made its choice.
Part 2. Attack your enemy where he is unprepared. Appear where you are not expected. Sun Tzu, The Art of War. Joint Base, Anacostia Bowling, Washington, D.C. Armando Chavez exhaled when he made the initial slice. As his mentor, Dr. Jimenez, had explained so long ago, the key to precision was to move slow but steady, advancing the blade at a consistent pace. The cut complete, Armando reached down, picked up the withered rose branch, and placed it into the faded canvas bag slung over his shoulder. Landscaping was a step down for someone with an MD from Universidad Central de Venezuela, but it was the only kind of work Armando had been able to get since he'd arrived as a refugee from the chaos in his homeland 7 years ago. He could get angry, or he could focus on achieving the little perfections that made life satisfying. As he trimmed the flowers at the base of the sign, he glanced at the etching in the black marble, Defense Intelligence Agency. He wasn't sure what the DIA did. Hadid, his supervisor, said it was something like the CIA, but for the U.S. military. It didn't matter. The landscaping crew was almost done here. After the break, Hadid said they would head over to trim the hedges behind the base's elder care center. Because of security, the landscapers were not allowed inside the building. When break time came, the others gathered in the shade, but Armando walked over to sit by the small decorative pond beside the entrance doors. He flipped open the tablet he kept in his pocket to see if he had any messages. The screen projected a 3D packet from his cousin back in Caracas. More pictures of his granddaughter. Such lovely eyes. Armando's smile went unnoticed by Allison Swig as she cut across the grassy field by the pond in her rush from the parking lot. The imagery analyst had gotten stuck in the traffic on I-295 on her way back from a networking lunch out at Tyson's Corner, and now she was late for the staff meeting. Neither of them noticed the other, but as she passed the landscaper, his tablet recognized the RFID chips embedded in Allison's security badge. A localized wireless network
formed for exactly 0.03 seconds. In that instant, the malware hidden in the video packet from Caracas made its jump. As Armando finished the iced tea his wife had made for him the previous night, Swig approached the security desk, manned by a guard in a black bullet-resistant nylon jumpsuit. A compact HKG-48 assault rifle hung from the glossy gray ceramic vest that protected his chest. The only insignia on his uniform was the eagle silhouette logo of the security company that guarded the DIA headquarters. "No personal devices allowed," read the sign suspended over a row of silver turnstiles.
"Hey, Steve," said Allison. "How's the little one?"
"Pretty good," the guard replied with a smile. "She slept through the night." She placed her ITAB bracelet in a metallic lockbox and pulled out the key. But Allison's badge stayed with her. As she walked toward the gate, the software in her badge automatically communicated her security clearance to the machine via a radio signal. And at the same moment of network linkage, the malware packet jumped again in less time than it would take to read the engraving on the entrance wall. "Committed to excellence in defense of the nation." The idea of using covert radio signals to ride malware into a network unconnected to the wider internet had actually been pioneered by the NSA, one of the DIA's sister agencies. But like all virtual weapons, once it was deployed in the open cyber world, it offered inspiration for anyone, including one's enemies. The turnstile gate lifted. Swig rushed down the hall, too far behind schedule to make her ritual stop at the Dunkin' Donuts stand just inside the spy agency's entrance. By the time she had passed the old Soviet SS-20 ballistic missile that stood mounted in the lobby like a Cold War totem pole, the malware packet had jumped from the gate onto another security guard's viz glasses. When the guard walked his rounds, the packet jumped into the environmental controls that cooled a closet full of network servers supporting aerial surveillance operations over Pakistan. After that, it went to an unmanned aircraft research and development team systems, and bit by bit, the malware worked its way into the various subnetworks that linked via the Defense Department's CIPRNet classified network. The initial penetrations didn't raise any alarms among the automated computer network defenses, always on the lookout for anomalies. At each stop, all the packet did was link with what appeared to the defenses as non-executables, harmless inert files, which they were, until the malware rearranged them into something new. Each of the systems had been air-gapped, isolated from the internet to prevent hackers from infiltrating them. The problem with high walls, though, was that someone could use an unsuspecting gardener to tunnel underneath them. Shanghai Jiao Tong University. A thin teenage girl stood behind a workstation, faintly glowing metallic smart rings on her fingers, one worn above each joint. Her expression was blank, her eyes hidden behind a matte black visor. Rows of similar workstations lined the converted lecture hall. Behind each stood a young engineering student, everyone a member of the 234th Information Brigade, Jiao Tong, a subunit of the 3rd Army Cyber Militia. On the arena floor, two directorate officers watched the workers. From their vantage point, the darkened arena seemed to be lit by thousands of fireflies as the students' hands wove faint neon green tracks through the air. Jiao Tong University had been formed in 1896 by Sheng Shuanghai, an official working for the Guangxu Emperor. The school was one of the original pillars of the self-strengthening movement, which advocated using Western technology to save the country from destitution. Over the following decades, the school grew to become China's most prestigious engineering university, nicknamed the Eastern MIT. Hu Feng hated that moniker, which made it seem as if her school were only a weak copy of an American original. Today, her generation would show that times had changed. The first university cyber militias had been formed after the 2001 Hainan Island incident. A Chinese fighter pilot had veered too close to an American Navy surveillance plane, and the two planes crashed in midair. The smaller Chinese plane spun to the earth, and its hot-dogging pilot was killed, while the American plane had to make an emergency landing at a Chinese airfield on Hainan. As each side angrily accused the other of causing the collision, the Communist Party encouraged computer-savvy Chinese citizens to deface American websites to show their collective displeasure. Young Chinese teens were organized online by the thousands and gleefully joined in the cyber vandalism campaign, targeting the homepage of everything from the White House to a public library in Minnesota. After the crisis, the hacker militias became crucial hubs of espionage, stealing online secrets that ranged from jet fighter designs to soft drink companies' negotiating strategies. That had all taken place before Hu Feng was born. She'd grown up sick from the smog. A hacking cough kept her from playing outside with the other kids. What Hu thought was a curse became a blessing. Her father, a professor of computer science in Beijing, had started her out writing code at age 3, mostly as a way to keep her busy inside their cramped apartment. Hu had been inducted into the 234th after she'd won a software writing competition at the age of 11. Officially, militia service fulfilled the directorate's universal military service requirement, but Hu would have volunteered anyway. She got to play with the latest technology, and the missions the officers gave her were usually fun. One day it might be hacking into a dissident smartphone, and another day it might entail tangling with the IT security at a Korean car designer. The Americans, though, were the best to toy with, so confident of their defenses.
If you pwned them,
the word taken from the Americans' own lingo for seizing digital control, the officers of the 234th noticed you. She'd done well enough that the apartment she and her father lived in now was much bigger than any of her father's colleagues. But it was not the reward that mattered to Hu. Rather, it was escaping the physical limitations that had once defined her life. LinkedIn, Hu felt like she was literally flying. Indeed, her gear worked on the same principles as the fly-by-wire controls on China's J-20 fighter. The powerful computers she drew on created a three-dimensional world that represented the global communications network that were her battlegrounds. She was among the few people who could boast that they had truly seen the Internet. Hu had made her mark by hacking phones belonging to civilian employees in the Pentagon. Despite the restrictions on employees bringing devices into the building, a few did so every day. Her technique involved co-opting a phone's camera and other onboard sensors to remotely recreate the owner's physical and electronic environment. This mosaic of pictures, sound, and electromagnetic signals helped the directorate produce an almost perfect 3D virtual rendition of the Pentagon's interior and its networks. She noticed with pleasure her pump kicking in. Access to the latest in medical technologies was another perk of the unit. The tiny pump, implanted beneath the skin near her navel, dumped a cocktail of methylphenidate and other stimulants into her circulatory system. Originally designed for children with attention deficit disorder, the mix produced a combination of focus and euphoria. For well over a decade, kids in America had popped prep pills to tackle tests and homework, which Hu thought was laughable. It was another sign of America's weakness, kids using this kind of power just to make it through schoolwork. Hu's pump enabled her to do something truly important. When she'd been told a week ago to prepare for a larger operation than they'd ever tried, she hacked the pump's operating system. It was a risk, but it paid off. She raised the dose level by 200%. No more steady-state awareness. Now it was like falling off a skyscraper and discovering you could fly right before you hit the ground. Hu moved her hands like a conductor, gently arcing her arms in elliptical gestures, almost swan-like. The movement of each joint of every finger communicated a command via the gyroscopes inside the smart ring. One typed out code on an invisible keyboard, while another acted as a computer mouse, clicking open network connections. Multiple different points, clicks, and typing actions all at once. To the officers watching below, it looked like an intricate ballet crossed with a tickling match. The young hacker focused on her attack, navigating the malware packet through the DIA networks, while fighting back the desire to brush a bead of sweat off her nose with her gloved hands. The Pentagon's autonomous network defenses, sensing the slight anomalies of her network streams, tried to identify and contain her attack. But this was where the integration of woman and machine triumphed over mere big data. Hu was already two steps ahead, building system components and then tearing them down before the data could be integrated enough for the DIA computers to see them as threats. Her left arm coiled and sprung, her fingers outstretched. Then the right did the same, this time a misdirect, steering the defense code to shut down further external access, essentially tricking the programs into focusing on locking the doors of a burning house, but leaving a small ember on the outside for them to stamp on, so they'd think the fire was out. Having gained access, she set about accomplishing the heart of her mission. Whose hands punched high, then her fingers flicked. She began inserting code that would randomize signals from the American's Global Positioning System satellite constellation. Some GPS signals would be off by just 2 meters. Others would be off by 200 kilometers. Of course, shutting it all down would be easy. But she could swing that hammer later. Today was all about sowing doubt and spreading confusion. 332 kilometers above the Earth's surface. If it weren't so frustrating, it would be funny. Less than a millimeter's worth of extra metal on just one bolt was about to derail an operation that involved literally billions of moving pieces of software and hardware. "Are you done yet?" asked Lieutenant Colonel Huan Zhou, an unmistakable edge in his voice. The wrench that Major Cheng Lu held in his gloved hand was a perfect copy of a Hexpando, just like the one that Colonel Farmer was banging at the ISS hatch with half an Earth orbit away. This wrench, though, had been produced from a design pirated by a patriotic hacker unit based in Shenzhen and manufactured at the manned space engineering office in Beijing. The problem was that, unlike the wrench, the bolt that Chang was trying to pry free was not a perfect copy and had become stuck. He pushed harder and harder, but it still wouldn't budge.
"Nearly," said Chang.
He saw the three other Taikonauts re-entering the Tiangong 3 space station. Lucky bastards. The Tiangong, Heavenly Palace, space station program had been planned ever since China launched its first manned crew into space in 2003. Western commentators had mocked those early Shenzhou vessels as poor copies of the United States' 1960s-era Gemini spacecraft. But the program rapidly advanced, aided by a healthy amount of NASA computer design files that found their way into Chinese engineers' hands. After the Shenzhous came the first Tiangong space station, a 10-meter-long, 8,000-kilogram single-module testbed that launched in 2011. It was the equivalent of NASA's 1970s-era Skylab. That was followed in 2015 by the multi-module Tiangong 2, which was 15 meters long and weighed 20,000 kilograms, comparable to NASA's 1990s design of the first ISS. Soon after, the program accelerated fast enough to finally match its competitors. Western commentators no longer mocked, but instead marveled that in a decade and a half, China had achieved what it had taken NASA 60 years to accomplish. The 25-meter-long, 60,000-kilogram Tiangong 3 space station was the pride of the nation, its launch celebrated with an official state holiday. It had 7 modules laid out in a T, including a core crew module that could support 6 Taikonauts, 4 solar panels that extended out 37 meters, and a docking port that could accommodate 4 ships. At the 2 upper ends of the T were parallel laboratory modules designed to conduct various experiments in microgravity. At least, that was what the rest of the world thought. The portside module actually had a different purpose, and now its cover just wouldn't shake free, all because of a single faulty titanium bolt. Chung realized that to get enough torque to pry the bolt loose, he'd have to untether, which was against protocol.
"Repositioning," said Chung.
"Negative," said Huan.
"Return and I will send someone to finish your work."
"There's no time," said Chung.
"I'm now off tether."
Chang heaved on the long wrench, and the bolt loosened. He easily removed the hatch cover and found himself staring into the mirrored surface of a laser's lens. He studied the Earth's reflection in it, and his own form superimposed above the peaceful blue beneath.
"Done," said Chang.
"I didn't think you had it in you, Chang. Good work,"
said Huan, the edge in his voice gone.
Chung re-secured himself to the space station and made his way to the main hatch, while Huan brought Tiangong 3's weapons online.
The station crew had realized they were moving to war footing 12 hours ago when Huan switched off the live viz feed of their activities, but it still felt slightly unreal. Once the Taikonauts were all inside the station, Huan powered up the weapons module. The chemical oxygen iodine laser, or COIL, design had originally been developed by the U.S. Air Force in the late 1970s. It had even been flown on a converted 747 jumbo jet, so the laser's ability to shoot down missiles in midair could be tested. But the Americans had ultimately decided that using chemicals in enclosed spaces to power lasers was too dangerous. The directorate saw it differently. Two modules away from the crew, a toxic mix of hydrogen peroxide and potassium hydroxide was being blended with gaseous chlorine and molecular iodine. This was really it, thought Chang, as he watched the power indicators turn red. There was no turning back once the chemicals had been mixed, and the excited oxygen began to transfer its energy to the weapon. They would have 45 minutes to act, and then the power would be spent. The firing protocol for mankind's first wartime shots in space was well rehearsed. The targets marked in the firing solution had been identified, prioritized, and tracked for well over a year in increasingly rigorous drills the crew eventually realized were not just to support war games down on Earth. The long hours spent in the lab would finally pay off.
"Ready to commence firing sequence?" said Juan. "Confirm."
One by one, the other Taikonauts checked in from their weapon stations. Chang touched the photo taped to the wall in front of him. His fingers lingered on the image of his beaming wife and their grinning 8-year-old son. The smiling Ming, missing his 2 front teeth, wore his father's blue Air Force officer's hat. What the photo did not show was how upset his wife had been when he'd given Ming that hat the night before. She thought it made her son look like a prop in a directorate propaganda piece. He moved his hand away from the photo and began his part of the operation, monitoring the targeting sequence. He startled even Juan when he cried out, "Ready!" For years, military planners had fretted about anti-satellite threats from ground-launched missiles, because that was how both the Americans and Soviets had intended to take down each other's satellite networks during the Cold War. More recently, the Directorate had fed this fear by developing its own anti-satellite missiles, and then alternating between missile tests and arms control negotiations that went nowhere, keeping the focus on the weapons based below. The Americans should have looked up. Chang snuck another look at the photo and caught Juan pausing, his trigger finger lingering above the red firing button. He appeared to be savoring the moment. Then Juan pressed the button. A quiet hum pervaded the module. No crash of cannon or screams of death, only the steady purr of a pump signified that the station was now at war. The first target was WGS-4, a U.S. Air Force wideband gap-filler satellite. Shaped like a box with 2 solar wings, the 3,400-kilogram satellite had entered space in 2012 on top of a Delta IV rocket launched from Cape Canaveral. Costing over $300 million, the satellite offered the U.S. military and its allies 4.875 gigahertz of instantaneous switchable bandwidth, allowing it to move massive amounts of data. Through it ran the communications for everything from U.S. Air Force satellites to U.S. Navy submarines. It was also a primary node for the U.S. Space Command. The Pentagon had planned to put up a whole constellation of these satellites to make the network less vulnerable to attack. But contractor cost overruns had kept the number down to just 6. The space station's chemical-powered laser fired a burst of energy that, if it were visible light instead of infrared, would have been 100,000 times brighter than the sun. 520 kilometers away, the first burst hit the satellite with a power roughly equivalent to a welding torch's. It melted a hole in the WGS-4's external atmospheric shielding, and then burned into its electronic guts. Chang watched as Juan clicked open a red pen and made a line on the wall next to him, much like a World War I ace decorating his biplane to mark a kill. The scripted moment had been ordered from below, a key scene for the documentary that would be made of the operation, a triumph that would be watched by billions.
"And there's the one," said Juan. "Chang, it is good for us all that you did not miss," he said as he clicked the pen shut with a flourish.
"Indeed," Chang said, and then smiling, he ad-libbed, "I would save you the trouble and walk myself out the airlock, resetting for target number 2.
Originally known as the X-37, USA-226 was the U.S. military's unmanned space plane. About an eighth the size of the old space shuttle, the tiny plane was used by the American government in much the same way the shuttle had been, to carry out various chores and repair jobs in space. It could rendezvous with satellites and refuel them, replace failed solar arrays using a robotic arm, and perform many other satellite upkeep tasks. But the Tiangong's crew and the rest of the world's militaries knew the U.S. military also used USA-226 as a space-going spy plane. It repeatedly flew over the same spots at the same altitude, notably the height typically used by military surveillance satellites, Pakistan for several weeks at a time, then Yemen and Kenya, and more recently, the Siberian border. With its primary control communications link via the WGS-4 satellite now lost, the tiny American space plane shifted into autonomous mode, its computers searching in vain for other guidance signals. In this interim period, USA-226's protocol was to cease acceleration and execute a standard orbit to avoid collisions. In effect, the robotic space plane stopped for its own safety, making it an easy target. The Tychonauts moved on down the list. The U.S. Geosynchronous Space Situational Awareness System was next. These were satellites that watched other satellites. The Americans' communications were now down, but once these satellites were taken out, the United States would be blind in space even if it proved able to bring its networks back online. After that was the mere 5 satellites that made up the U.S. military's mobile user objective system, akin to a global cellular phone provider for the military. 5 pulses took out the narrowband communications network that linked all the American military's aerial and maritime platforms, ground vehicles, and dismounted soldiers. Then came the U.S. Navy's ultra-high-frequency follow-on, UFO system, which linked all of its ships. It was almost anticlimactic. The onboard targeting system moving the Tychonauts through the attack's algorithm step by step, slowing down only when a cluster of satellites sharing a common altitude needed to be dispatched one by one. The last to be serviced, as Juan dryly put it, was a charged particle detector satellite. The joint NASA and Energy Department system had been launched a few years after the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster as a way to detect radiation emissions. A volley of laser fire from Tiangong 3 exploded its fuel source. When Juan finally put the pen back in his suit pocket, there were 47 marks on the wall. They had been told that the ISS would be taken care of by other means. On the other side of the Earth, discarded booster rockets were coming to life after months of dormancy. The boosters turned kamikazes advanced on collision courses, with nearby American government and commercial communications and imaging satellites. The American ground controllers helplessly watched the chaos overhead, unable to maneuver their precious assets out of the way. "I will run diagnostics and flush the laser power systems," said Chang. He kept moving in order to avoid thinking about what was happening on the Earth's surface below. "Good," said Juan. "Then see if you can pull up the imagery from the attack. I want to watch it again later." "Of course you do," thought Chang. USS Coronado, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam, Hawaii. The coffee was just like that first cup his father had allowed him to sip from back when he was 7. No sugar, no cream. It had tasted acrid, awful, not like the vanilla-flavored lattes his mom had loved. "When you're in the Navy, you don't have time on board to add in all that junk," his father had explained, typical of the kind of advice he gave his kids. The bosun's mate, in charge of brewing up the coffee on the USS Coronado, was no barista either, and so the bridge crew all sipped his awful coffee, watching the harbor wake up around them. Stim tabs and the other pharma provided by the corpsman worked better, but the Navy clung to its traditions. The bitter coffee was as much a part of the morning watch as the sunrise. Simmons set down his mug and eyed the sunlight illuminating the Coronado's deck. The LCS had just celebrated its 10th birthday. But Jamie still thought the sharp, triple-hulled trimaran design gave it the look of a futuristic starship, like out of a Star Wars movie. His dad loved that old stuff, so much so that he had taken Jamie and his sister, Mackenzie, to one of the reboot movies when they were way too young to understand it. Their mother had gotten so mad when she'd found out. It was still a good memory, though. Mackenzie coming home with the empty paper popcorn bucket, cherishing it
in the way that little kids make souvenirs of the most mundane objects. That was one of the few happy memories from before his father left, before Mackenzie died. Simmons walked over to a spot near one of the port windows to inspect a blemish no bigger than a quarter. He ran his finger over the epoxy patch. On the last anti-piracy patrol, a burst of machine gun fire had gone right through the window, and two spots below in the ship's aluminum superstructure, now also repaired. No one had been hurt, fortunately, but it reminded the crew that the LCS had been designed for speed, not for heavy combat. Some of the crew had later wrapped Captain Riley's chair in aluminum foil as ballistic protection, a joke that went over poorly with the captain. As Simmons watched the morning sun paint the other warships in the crowded harbor orange, he savored the moment, knowing this was one of the last times he would command the bridge. He'd let Riley know what he'd decided when they arrived in San Diego. Petty Officer Third Class Randall Jefferson, a young sailor on the bridge, approached, looking almost sheepish when he saw the XO lost in thought.
"Sir, I'm sorry to disturb you, but you asked me to notify you if anything came up," said Jefferson. "The sonar grid picked up movement. It just flashes in and out right up near the ship. It's probably some fish or a dolphin."
"Don't apologize for not letting your guard down in port. Deploy Remus and let's take a look."
He gave the orders to lower what looked like a neon-yellow torpedo into the water. Remus, the remote environmental monitoring units, had actually started out in the commercial sector, much like its mother ship's original design as a high-speed ferry. The unmanned underwater system, essentially a robotic miniature submarine, had been developed at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, mainly for civilian applications, like port facility inspection, pollution monitoring, and underwater surveying. It was a mainstay of Discovery and Travel Channel sims. But what worked to capture Shark Week footage also worked for underwater guard duty. Simmons entered the bridge and stood behind Jefferson, who was now operating the mini-sub with a first-generation Sony PlayStation-type controller. The handheld video game-style controller was supposed to be intuitive for the sailors, but it felt more like a relic to a generation who now gamed in 3D immersion. The vid from Remus played out alongside a live overhead satellite feed of the ship's position, a pattern analysis of surface and air traffic around their position, and a multicolor spherical chart that showed status reports of the crew and ship systems.
"Not picking anything up on thermal, sir," said Jefferson. "Let's see what visual has."
"Give me the full screen," said Simmons.
The camera pivoted and showed a gray mass of shadows on the screen. Simmons squinted, as if willing the murky water to reveal its secrets.
"Hello there," said Jefferson.
He zoomed the camera in on a dark form slowly circling under the ship's stern. The camera began to focus. There, no mistaking it, against the dark blue background, was the faint silhouette of a diver.
"Some damn fool local out messing around where he shouldn't," said Jefferson.
But then the diver stopped and raised his arms above his head as if praying beneath the LCS's hull.
"He's got something in his hands," said Jefferson.
The diver held what looked like a trash can lid. He lazily kicked his feet and inched closer to the Coronado's hull. Simmons fought down the coffee climbing back up into his throat.
"Sound force protection alert! Possible terror attack! FP condition Delta!" shouted Simmons. "And wake the captain! Tell him we have a diver placing what looks like a limpet mine on the hull!"
He picked up a headset and steadied his voice, knowing any fear in it would resonate throughout the ship.
"This is the XO, force protection security team to the port side. Cycle rudders and energized sonars. Set material condition zebra," Simmons said. "FP team, we have a diver attempting to place an explosive device on the hull. I want him off. Batteries release, fire at will."
Chaos broke out as sailors ran to the port side and tried to see where the diver was. Through the bridge's open hatch, Simmons heard the shouts getting increasingly desperate.
"There he is! No, he's over there!"
"Get the hell out of my way!"
yelled Petty Officer Anton Horowitz. He had been standing guard duty by the gangway on the starboard side, and he pushed his way through the scrum to the port side. Horowitz leaned as far over the railing as he could and fired his M4 carbine methodically into the water,
making a looping pattern of splashes from bow to stern. It was a strange thought to have in the middle of a terror attack, Horowitz knew, but this was actually fun. He had re-enlisted only 2 months ago for just this kind of work, with a promise from the skipper that he'd be allowed to try out for the SEALs. He'd already submitted the required DNA and blood samples for SEAL selection, and had been maxing his hypertrophy workouts. Back on the bridge, Jefferson saw the ripples of Horowitz's bullets, made as tiny white lines on his screen that stopped after a few feet. When he switched to thermal view, they looked like a series of yellow needles jabbing into the water that quickly disappeared as their heat dissipated. Many were perilously close to the Remus, but few were near the diver.
"Sir, they're not getting him," said Jefferson.
"Swing Remus around and maneuver 200 meters away. Then I want you to bring it back full speed at us," said Simmons.
"Sir?"
asked Jefferson. 250 meters above Tokyo, Japan. They had said Tokyo was big, but up close, it seemed to go on forever. Captain Third Rank Alexei Denisov's MiG-35K fighter bomber was doing 875 kilometers per hour, just beneath the sound barrier, to avoid leaving a telltale sonic boom. And yet, the dense buildings below seemed like they would never end. The plan seemed to be working, though. The threat detection icon on the luminous screen at his right did not register anything urgent. He kept his finger on the toggle switch for the plane's multifunction self-protection jammer, but so far, the fighter had been unchallenged. The reason was simple. The U.S.-Japanese Combined Air Defense Network was designed for a threat from China to the west, and east was where Denisov and his 22 other fighter bombers had launched from the Admiral Kuznetsov. The Russian aircraft carrier was believed to be on exercises in the North Pacific, out of range of Chinese airstrikes. In fact, it had waited for a gap in satellite coverage and darted south at 30 knots for 8 hours, moving just within the strike package's range. The MiGs flew in fast and low, and once they were over Japan, they popped up to mimic the flight paths that commuter jets took from Narita Airport. Denisov's MiGs radar warning receiver rumbled as signals from an early warning radar near Narita washed over it, this time close enough to overcome the plane's stealth features. Denisov's radio picked up the frantic calls of the air traffic controller. He hit the button, and a digital recording began to play. It sounded like gibberish to him, but the FSB officer back on the Kuznetsov had been clear about the need to play it at just this moment. To the air traffic controller on the ground, it sounded like the pilot of one of Sony's executive jets was having a heart attack. As the MiG passed Miyazaki and turned again toward the Ryukyu Islands, it was clear that the defenses were finally onto them. Denisov's radar scope showed four Japan Air Self-Defense Force F-15s were vectoring as fast as they could. But they wouldn't get there in time. The ruse had bought Denisov only a few minutes, but it should be enough. After scanning the sky above him for any incoming fighters, Denisov said a quick prayer for his men and his country. For himself, there was no need. A commander could operate only with certainty, not fear. He expected losses today, but also success. His latest imagery of one of his targets showed just 11 U.S. aircraft parked inside their hardened hangars. Dozens remained out in the open, as usual. The MiGs dove to a low altitude and pushed forward to their full sea-level velocity of nearly 1,500 kilometers per hour, well over the speed of sound. The new MiG-35Ks were called fourth-generation-plus fighters by the Americans. They weren't fully stealthy, but they had a significantly reduced radar signature. Each second counted now. When the jets neared Okinawa, Denisov's radar warning receiver lit with a pulsing red icon. The Patriot 4 missile batteries that the Japanese had acquired from the Americans were tracking his low-flying fighter. They had him in their sights and could knock him down at will. This was a crucial component of the plan. He took a deep breath and waited, telling himself that the missiles were threats only if someone pushed the launch button. Japan's air self-defense forces, however, were not authorized to fire on targets without permission from that country's civilian leadership. The gamble was that permission wouldn't come in time. 2 decades of near-daily airspace incursions by Chinese aircraft would have desensitized the Japanese,
plus their communications networks were supposed to have been knocked offline by cyber attacks. At least, that was the plan. All the more reason not to miss on this first free run, Major Denisov had told his men during their pre-flight briefing. You are about to fire the most important shots of your lives, and they may be your last. Make them count. There was no rallying call to glory over the flight's communications. The only sounds on the radio this time were digital recordings of the voices of American F-22 Raptor pilots copied by a surveillance ship that had monitored the RIMPAC war games held each year off Hawaii. Anything to create uncertainty and delay the Japanese and American response by just a few more seconds. The silent progress of an icon in his jet's heads-up display told him he had arrived. Kadena Air Base. His war started here. A flash of movement caught Denisov's eye as four dark gray darts raced ahead of his squadron. It was a volley of Sokols, Falcons, fired by his second flight. A sort of miniaturized cruise missile. The electromagnetic weapon used pulses of directed energy to knock out air defense and communication systems. Following a pre-programmed course, the flight of Falcon missiles separated, each leaving a swath of electronic dead zone behind it. If his flight's opening shots were silent, the next wave of destruction would be deafening. Denisov released four RBK-500 cluster bombs over the unprotected U.S. Air Force planes parked near the base's 3.5-kilometer-long runway. As he banked his MiG, he caught a glimpse of an F-35A Lightning II being towed out of its hangar in a rush to confront him. His MiG was designed to be a match for the F-35, and the pilots of both had always wondered how the planes would actually stack up against each other. It would have to wait for some other time. The RBK canisters opened up behind Denisov's plane, releasing hundreds of cluster bomblets, each the size of a beer can. Tiny parachutes deployed and the cans drifted toward the ground. When proximity fuses detected that they were 10 meters from the ground, the cans exploded, one after another. Hundreds of explosions ripped across the airbase, blowing open scores of the U.S. Air Force's most advanced fighters. Denisov's wingman made the next run and dropped three penetrating anti-runway bombs. The hardened tips of the massive bombs buried themselves almost 5 meters into the runway's concrete and then detonated with more than 1,500 kilograms worth of explosives. While the limited number of American jets protected in hardened hangars might survive Denisov's bombs, none would be taking off from the biggest U.S. air base in the Pacific for days, if not weeks. 6 kilometers away, the flight's two trailing MiG-35Ks split past each other, and then banked back hard as they raced toward the center of an imaginary X. That X was located in the middle of the largest U.S. Marine Corps base in Japan. The 9,000 Marines living there were supposed to have been moved to Guam 5 years earlier, but political wrangling between Congress and the Japanese government over just who would pay the $8.6 billion tab to relocate the Marines had delayed the transfer of forces. Time had run out. The two planes passed each other at less than 100 meters. At the imaginary point of their crossing lines, the MiGs dropped four KAB-1500S thermobaric bombs, each weighing just over 1,300 kilograms. The bombs opened to release a massive cloud of explosive vapor, which was then ignited by a separate charge. It was the largest explosion Japan had experienced since Nagasaki, and it left a similar mushroom cloud of smoke and dust hanging over the base as the jets flew away. Denisov finally turned off the spoof audio recording and ordered his flight to report in. The strikes on the air bases, the ground bases, and even the U.S. Navy aircraft carrier harbored offshore had been a success. He'd lost only 5 jets to the late reacting air defenses. Amazing. He wasn't sure the Americans would appreciate the irony of the Russians following the same plan of attack the Americans had used on the Japanese some 80 years earlier. But Plan Doolittle had worked. Trying to conceal the relief in his voice, he ordered the remaining fighters to bank toward the Chinese coast. That was the other part they'd copied from the raid the Americans had pulled back in the early months of their previous war in the Pacific, by coming in from an unexpected approach and making it a one-direction flight. They could strike at twice the range the enemy believed possible. The Russian Navy
had held up its end. Now, it had to trust that the Chinese aerial refueling tankers would be there as promised. The raid wasn't Denisov's idea, but neither had the original raid back in World War II been Jimmy Doolittle's idea. Maybe, he thought, history would call this one after its commander as well. Denisov's raid had a nice ring to it. USS Coronado, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam, Hawaii. From the deck of the Coronado, Horowitz saw a sudden ripple in the water where the Remus had turned, almost like what a fly fisherman would take for a fish rising. It made him pause. Then he focused on firing at the threat. The shell casings bounced off the deck and into the water, sizzling as they floated for a brief moment and then sinking beneath the surface. "Remus is coming back around, sir," said Jefferson on the bridge. "What now?" "I want you to ram it up that diver's ass," said Simmons. "Aye, aye, sir." Jefferson gently nudged the joystick to the right and then the left, centering the diver on the screen. Then he throttled it to full speed. On deck, Horowitz's M4 clicked. His magazine was empty. Without looking, he reached into the pouch attached to his belt for another magazine and tried to slam it into the rifle. But his last mag slipped from his hands into the water. 30 rounds that could have made the difference were lost. Horowitz cursed at the water as only a sailor could, but stopped when he saw a fast-moving shape coming toward the ship. Great, not just terrorists, but torpedoes now. The underwater view was projected onto the Remus control station. The diver was in the midst of attaching the mine to the hull when some sixth sense warned him what was coming. He turned his head to look over his shoulder. The last picture on Jefferson's video screen was the diver's surprised expression behind the goggles, just before the Remus smashed into his left jaw and then plowed into the ship's hull behind him. On deck, Horowitz felt the crunch of the Remus impact and then saw a roaring wall of white water flash up, and then silence. Ruby Empress, Gatun Lake, Panama Canal. Arnel Reyes picked at a flake of black paint from the rail of the Ruby Empress, a Cyprus-flagged oil tanker. "I like blue, you know, like the sky in the afternoon, and as a little boy he will love it," said his wife. Arnel wanted to say that neither a newborn baby nor a full-grown man could care less about wall colors, but it was best to humor her with all the love he could scrape up, especially given that he was standing on the deck of a ship in the Panama Canal and she was back home in Manila. "Blue it is, my love. I'll be back in 2 weeks and we can paint for him then," he said. "We've got plenty of time, you know."
"There's not enough time with you gone. There's just so much to do. And we haven't even talked about his name," Anna Maria said over the phone. "Baby, I know your mother thought—"
Then the call dropped. He worried Anna Maria would think he'd hung up on her, but when he tried to reconnect, the call wouldn't go through. He put his phone back in his pocket and leaned away from the hot deck rail. It didn't help his mood that the transit through the Panama Canal was the slowest part of the trip, since ships had to wait in line to make their way through the canal locks. As Reyes climbed back up the series of ladders, he heard the commotion on the Ruby's bridge. Everything was squared away aboard the ship, but the radios were alive with traffic. Two ships ahead, the Xiang Humen, a Chinese-flagged freighter, had turned on its engines. This was craziness. What was Xiang Humen's captain thinking, speeding up inside the transit zone? The canal master was screaming over the radio for the Xiang Humen to acknowledge and stop, but there was no reply. Reyes ran topside to see. It was like watching a slow-motion train wreck. The Xiang Humen was moving at a mere 4 knots, slower than a jog. But with 120,000 tons of force behind it, the ship slowly ground its way into the canal locks, crushing the doors inward. Reyes wasn't sure how long it would take the Chinese companies that ran the Panama Canal Zone to fix this mess, but their investment had clearly gone down the tubes.
"Well, it's not my $180 billion, said Reyes to one of the crew, who chuckled in reply. In any case, the highway between the oceans was likely going to be closed for a while.
He reached into his pocket. He'd better try to call his wife again. USS Coronado, Joint Base, Pearl Harbor, Hickam, Hawaii. When Horowitz came to, he was floating on his back in the water. A broken shard of yellow metal drifted a few feet away, and just beyond that was the diver's body, floating face down. He looked up at the Coronado, trying to remember how he'd gotten here. His ears rang and his head ached worse than any shore leave hangover. He saw the XO looking down at him from the bridge. He saluted the officer from the water, and the XO smiled and saluted back. A launch pulled Horowitz and the black-clad body out of the water. The sailors hauled him aboard with smiles, but they handled the body with fear. The launch stopped beside the Coronado, and the diver was carried up to the helicopter deck at the stern. Horowitz scrambled up after it and joined the small crowd that had quickly gathered around the body. They all spoke quietly around the dead diver, as if worried their voices might revive him.
"Don't shove me," said a sailor. "I gotta viz this."
"You can't do that," whispered another. "He's dead. You know the rules."
"Exo's coming back,"
a voice hissed, and the crowd tensed and drew back into order, parting to allow Simmons through.
"Nothing like a morning swim, Horowitz," Simmons observed with a smile. "You solid?"
"Aye, sir," Horowitz replied. "Can't say the same for my swim buddy here."
A sailor pulled off the diver's mask to reveal bulging eyes. Horowitz felt his stomach turn. The left side of the man's jaw was bloody and caved in, but the rest of the dead man's features were still intact. With his cropped blonde hair, he looked almost like a sleeping Viking.
"We get the right guy?" asked one of the sailors. "He don't look like any jihadi I've seen before."
Someone handed Simmons the broken dive mask. He turned it over in his hands, careful not to cut himself on the shards of plastic, and then knelt down to look closer at the body. A delicate scar on the chin and a nose that looked as though it had been broken as regularly as a boxer's.
"Roll him over," said Simmons.
As they turned the man, Horowitz noticed that the diver's suit wasn't neoprene. It was made of something thicker. Then he saw the man wasn't wearing conventional scuba gear.
"Sir, that's a closed rebreather unit," said Horowitz. "Seals use them to swim without the bubbles. The wetsuit's got some thermal masking going on, too."
Simmons nodded and studied the gear being stripped off the body. The dive computers strapped to the dead man's wrists looked sleek, clearly mill-grade. They also had Chinese markings on a protective cover. The men looked confused as the XO sprinted back to the bridge without a word. It wasn't a big ship, and Simmons was at the bridge within 25 seconds. Riley was there now, still in his skivvies but wearing his blue USS Coronado baseball cap, with the CO's scrambled eggs insignia sewn in gold thread above the brim. Jefferson was playing the Remus video back for him. Riley turned to see Simmons burst into the room. Simmons didn't walk around the projected screen, but went right through it, rippling the picture.
"Got him?" said Riley.
Simmons seemed to ignore him, and looked right at the communications officer.
"Get Packham on the horn now. Prep and op rep, 3 pinnacle message."
Any message with pinnacle in the identification line was automatically flagged of interest, not just to the entire Navy chain of command, but also to the National Military Command Center, which monitored events for the Joint Chiefs and the President.
"That's a little extreme for one diver, XO. Let's notify the duty sonar ship first and see if they have any further info," said Riley.
"Too slow. We need to send a pinnacle out now, sir," said Simmons.
The communications tech looked from Simmons to Riley.
"Sirs, nothing's working here. I can't even get my own phone to hook onto the network. It's like the whole spectrum is down."
On the main deck below, Horowitz rubbed the ache at the base of his neck. He angrily slammed another magazine he'd cadged from a fellow sailor into his M4. They found his weapon still lying on the deck. He absent-mindedly ran his tongue across his lips, realizing he was thirsty despite being soaking wet. He read that this was what happened when you went into shock, but he wasn't going to say anything about it now. Falling off the ship and then bitching about being scared seemed like a good way to blow his shot at becoming a SEAL. Horowitz looked around the harbor at the wall of U.S. Navy steel assembled there. He couldn't wait to get to sea and wreak some revenge on whoever had done it.
Then the USS Abraham Lincoln, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier tied up just across the harbor, seemed to lift a few feet from the water, as if the 100,000-ton ship were being conjured skyward. The shove of the blast wave pushed him back to the bulkhead. As he scrambled to his feet, Horowitz stared agape as the Nimitz-class carrier settled back into the water with orange flames and black smoke pouring from its deck. He watched as the carrier's hull began to break apart about two-thirds of the way down from the bow.
"Oh, shit, the reactors," muttered Horowitz.
Pier 29, Port of Honolulu, Hawaii. What the hell? They weren't supposed to be offloading for another day. When he'd first seen the ramp come down, Jacob Sanders had pulled out his tablet to recheck the manifest. The Golden Wave, 720 feet, flagged out of Liberia. A RORO carrying cars from Shanghai. It had been pre-cleared on the manifest, but it was 24 hours early, and now it was screwing up his day. Even standing in the guard shack in the neighboring parking lot, he could feel the impact of the double-wide metal ramp slamming down onto the pier. Sanders had always thought the big roll-on, roll-off ship had the aesthetic appeal of a Costco plunked down on top of a boat. But that was the idea. It could carry 550 vehicles, and those vehicles could drive right off the ship and into his lot. Then they would sit, waiting to be driven to various dealerships around the island. Sanders tried to raise his boss on the radio, but all he got was static. He shook his head and looked down to check the time and date on his Casio G-Lite watch. Yep, he had it right. They were offloading too soon. More important, the web-enabled watch's last update showed that the offshore buoy readings looked promising for some head-high swells. Just 5 more hours in the lot, and then he'd be free of his guard shack and back in the water at Kualos. If the surf was as good as his watch promised, it would be one of those days when it just didn't matter where you'd gone to school or that you wore a black polyester uniform on land. A series of distant booms snapped his attention from his watch. He hit the deck and covered his head with his arms as the shack's flimsy metal walls shook. After a few seconds, he got to his knees and peered through the open door at the fuel tank farm next to Pier 29. No fire. Blue skies didn't indicate thunder. Then the pier began to vibrate again from another low rumble, like an earthquake. Damn, he didn't want to be caught here by the water if it led to a tsunami. More distant booms echoed off the hills, but the noise was washed out by hundreds of motors starting up inside the Golden Wave. What were they doing? Didn't they feel the quake? There could be more aftershocks. Sanders remembered the public service announcements he'd watched as a kid, said you should stand in a doorway during an earthquake. But he looked at the flimsy shack walls and then crawled outside. He felt more booms reverberate and saw some smoke rising behind the Golden Wave. But the bulk of the huge ship blocked whatever was happening across the harbor. Then, one of those new Geely SUVs rolled down the ramp. Maybe they were trying to get the cars off before another quake? But where were they going to park them? They'd be better off keeping them on the ship and riding it out. Sanders watched as another and then another of the SUVs moved down the ramp and parked. He'd always thought the Geely looked like a ripped-off Range Rover Defilade. But they were so cheap that he could almost afford one. The paint sure sucked, though. The first dozen were a decent silver or blue, but the rest were a faded matte green. Then he heard a piercing squeal, like something gouging the steel deck of the ship. Behind the last SUV, what looked like a telephone pole on its end gradually emerged and pointed down the ramp. Behind that pole was a massive green bulk that slowly nosed its way out to the top of the ramp and then tilted downward. Shit, that was a tank. Then another tank moved down the ramp, followed by an 8-wheeled vehicle that looked like a tank's little brother. Sanders saw the red stars on the tank. What were Chinese tanks doing coming off the ship? The manifest said nothing about that. And who the hell would be buying those? Maybe they were for training exercises out of Camp Schofield? Jacob looked around and realized he was alone. His next move was to bring out his phone and start shooting video. It would be worth a couple beers. Maybe he could even sell it on the VizNet. Then what looked like 6 beer kegs flew up into the air and raced toward downtown.
Drones? Sanders said in a whisper.
Each squat pigeon surveillance drone was indeed about the size of a 14-gallon beer keg, and each had a small rotor bay at its bottom. They all took off to seek out the highest points in Honolulu, where they would land. From these perches, the unarmed pigeons could suck in electromagnetic and digital signals, and then throw out an island-wide wave of electronic disturbance. Just then, Jacob heard another bang on the pier. It was the ramp coming down off the Hildy Manor, another RORO tied up beyond the Golden Wave. None of this shit was authorized. They didn't have the paperwork, and the lot was already going to be jammed. There was no way he'd be able to fit the cars from not one but two ships into the waiting lot, let alone a bunch of tanks. He held the phone at arm's length, cursing his stupid job again, this time because he couldn't afford some viz glasses.
"Jacob Sanders at Pier 29 in Honolulu," he said, staring into the pinhole camera. "Got an unauthorized delivery here, as you can see," Sanders said. "Some trucks, ghillies, and check this out, tanks. Chinese tanks. Not sure what the drill is today, but we're about to go find out. Bet you never saw anything like this in real life. Me either, stay tuned."
Sanders set his phone on the windowsill in his shack so that it was recording the scene, and then marched with a bold step toward the Golden Wave. Dumbass sailors. They'd just have to stay on the pier until it all got sorted out. By the time Sanders had made his way to the ramp that connected the pier to the parking lot, he could literally feel the power of the tank's engines in his chest. The tanks slowly moved forward, a few feet at a time, testing the ramp. A flash of movement and an ear-splitting clang made him whip his head around. Big metal panels were being tossed over the side of the Evening Resolve, a 480-foot cargo container ship registered in Dalian, and landing on the pier. Then, a miniature air force began to assemble in formation above the Evening Resolve. To Sanders, the quadcopters looked like those spy drones the paparazzi used to buzz any Hollywood star dumb enough to still have an outdoor wedding. The directorate's electric V-1000 drone actually shared a heritage with the commercial systems, but its agility and stealth had made it the platform of choice for covert Chinese risk elimination, strikes in Africa and the former Republic of Indonesia. The tanks throttled their engines again and regained Sanders' attention. He raised his right hand in the universal sign to stop.
"Halt! You are entering private property. I need you to stop that vehicle immediately."
The lead tank slowed and then stopped at the bottom of the ramp, just 10 feet away. Sanders looked down and raised his voice, more confident now that he had established who was in charge.
"Good. Now, I don't know what's going on, but you need to turn that vehicle around and get back on the ship immediately."
The engine belched smoke, and the tank suddenly bounded forward. Seen on the screen of his phone, it looked like a symbolic act of bravery. In actuality, all Jacob would think about was running, running as fast as he could to get out of the 60-ton beast's path, but his feet just wouldn't move. Marine Corps Base, Kaneoha Bay, Hawaii. Captain Charles Carlisle was losing patience with his crew chief. In other words, it was just another day in paradise with a jet more finicky than his fiancée. The 25mm gun pod on his F-35B Lightning II fighter kept jamming after each helicopter-like vertical landing he performed. This was the fourth time this week, but no one could figure out why. The plane's automatic maintenance computers were supposed to point fingers at any gremlins, but adding more to the 24 million lines of software code already in there just proved Murphy's Law beat Moore's Law every time.
"I don't know what to tell you, Worm," said Miller, the civilian crew chief, using the call sign Carlisle had earned after losing his rations and living off worms during the survival and evasion phase of his pilot training.
"I didn't design these planes, I just fix them."
Worm shook his head. He'd never understood why the Marine Corps put the world's best pilots in the cockpits of the world's most expensive weapons system, only to turn maintenance over to the lowest bidder. Worm was about to offer another round of profane observations about what $1.5 trillion ought to buy, like, for instance, a working gun, but then he held his breath and listened. Weird. a series of bass-like thumps. Then he heard the buzzing of rotors. It came from the direction of Pearl and moved toward the air station located on the Mukapu Peninsula. The blood drained from the aviator's face when he saw the incoming flight of choppers and tiny quadcopter drones.
"Get the fuel hose off now," Worm shouted.
The crew chief was about to argue when he tracked the pilot's gaze and saw the formation. Miller looked old, but he was down on the ground before the first wave of rockets hit the hangar complex on the other side of the 7,800-foot runway.
"Miller up! Get up!" shouted Worm.
Lying prone, Miller watched four of the quadcopters dive and attack a communications tower at the end of the runway. Just before the V-1000s launched a volley of micro-rockets, they flared back into formation, which made them look like X's on a fiery tic-tac-toe board.
"I'm on it," said Miller.
You could question his competence, but you couldn't fault the man's bravery, thought Worm. As the two men worked to pull the fuel line from the F-35, Miller spoke between panting breaths.
"Chinese?" he said. "Doesn't matter," said Worm. "Get me up there, and I'll send a few down here for you to pick through and find out."
They could see the drone helicopters methodically working their way across the base's hangar buildings, hitting one aircraft after the other. That they remained in an X formation the whole time made the attack seem all the more menacing. A few Marines shot rifles at them, only to be taken out by rocket fire from above. Fortunately, Worm's F-35B, like its predecessor, the Harrier jump jet, didn't need to approach the killing field of the runway. The aircraft had a shaft-driven fan in the middle of its fuselage that could lift the jet into the air like a helicopter, once the main jet engine pushed it forward with over 40,000 pounds of thrust. The trade-off of packing a second engine in the middle of the plane was that the Marine version of the F-35 couldn't carry as much payload, but Worm's jet would be flying with a light load anyway. The good news was that the training exercise they had been prepping for was a live fire drill. The bad news was it was for close air support, so he was loaded with only dummy air-to-air missiles with a gun pod he couldn't trust. Worm clambered into the cockpit and looked down at Miller, the top half of his head encased in a heads-up display.